Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
I've long spoken of my next guest as one of the wisest people in the Australian public square. I'm sure he'll be embarrassed. One of the reasons is that he spent a great deal of his career listening. And that fact has a large bearing on his latest, quite provocative thinking that we are messaging each other to death. He asks whether amidst the rush and crush of technology and communication, in this age, have we lost the art of thinking, of pausing? Are we edgy about silence? Is there any space anymore for quiet reflection? For so often, therein lies wisdom. My guest is social researcher Hugh McKay. Hugh, welcome to Open House.
Thanks very much, Lee.
It's wonderful to have you in. Hugh, your thoughts on this age in which we live seem to have been percolating for some time, and also out of your own personal experience in a couple of contexts. What are they?
Yes, this really came home to me recently in, as you say, two experiences I had. One was at the theatre. I went, made a huge mistake. I went to see Bertolt Brecht's first play, a play called Baal, which he wrote when he was 19. It's a shocker. but the play was bad. The production was appalling. And what happened reminded me of what increasingly happens now when you go to the theatre. Yeah. The audience files into an empty theatre expecting that lovely little moment of anticipation when you're waiting for the curtain to go up, even if there isn't a curtain, metaphorically to go up.
Yes.
The time of preparation and just reflection and, oh, I wonder what this will be like and so on. But theatre directors increasingly don't want you to have that time. They want to hit you with a show before the show.
Yeah.
And in the case of Baal, the show before the show was the lead actor sitting on the stage with an electric guitar, which he was activating with a beer can. Now, try it.
Never seen that trick before.
Well, what was produced, and very loudly amplified, what was produced was a kind of, of course it wasn't music, it was a shrieking electronic sound, which had members of the audience with their hands over their ears and looking, you know, sort of panicky about what is this, and looking at the sound man, wondering why he wasn't doing something about it. In other words, it was the director abusing us, but it was also the director in the current fashion saying, we won't let the audience just sit and reflect and wait for the first word of the play as written by the playwright. We'll bombard them.
Yeah.
The other thing that that triggered this recent piece I wrote in the Sydney Morning Herald was an experience of speaking at a conference. And I do quite a lot of conference speaking, but I noticed that the trend with many conferences is towards no time to develop ideas and themes and no time for the audience to reflect and discuss.
Okay.
So this one, 15 minutes max, you know, bang, 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 one speaker after the other, 15 minutes for each, and then a few minutes for questions. In fact, at another conference I attended recently, the questions weren't even asked by members of the audience. They were sent by SMS text to the chairman of the panel
which they
discussion.
Probably think is all very smart and very modern.
Yeah, that's right. Isn't this slick? Isn't this sophisticated?
Yeah.
And, of course, what it means is no eye contact with the person who asked the question because you have no idea who that was. And, of course, everyone in the audience is thereby given permission to have their phone out, purportedly sending questions, but maybe checking the cricket score or whatever else they might be doing. And it also, of course, gave the chairman of that panel iron control over what questions would be asked, and he filtered them and synthesized them. So you never felt there was this thing that's so magic in a conference or in a conversation like the one we're having right now, which is when you're face-to-face with someone and you've got time not just to hear what they're saying but to read them, you know, and all those visual messages that come out of the face-to-face encounter are so important. But we're speeding things up. That was the thing that struck me both in the play and in the conference. We're speeding things up. We're revving up our lives, courtesy propelled by this new technology, but it's stripping the silence out. It's stripping the time for thinking and meditating and interpreting.
When you said that about the play, I just thought one of the favourite things for me when I go to a live concert is when I arrive there and there's no music there, but all these magnificent instruments just sitting there, dormant, waiting for really clever people to pick them up and make beautiful music.
Yes.
That's a really big attraction for me.
Yes.
I don't need the noise before.
No, that's right. Well, you go to a concert, anticipating what you've just described, tomorrow, if you did it, you're likely to have someone rushing up and down the aisle playing a saxophone or banging a drum.
Or sticking a microphone or a camera in front of you.
Yeah, face. That's right. It's as though there's an assumption by theatre directors, by conference organisers, by preachers, by politicians, by lots of people. There seems to be an assumption that we're now not comfortable with silence or with a little bit of a pause. It's as though that makes us a bit edgy and nervous, and perhaps it does. We've become so used to being immersed in data and endlessly stimulated.
Yes. Do you think that's right, that we can't handle peace anymore or reflection or some quiet in our life?
No, I certainly don't think we can't do it, but yes. I think we have to be reminded and retrained to recognise the importance of it. I've been struck talking to some teachers and school principals who are saying in some schools now they have a sort of decompression zone at the beginning of the day where the kids just have some time, 15 minutes maybe, of silence. They can read if they want to, but there's no electronics, there's no stimulation. They basically just wind down, turn your mobile phones off, yes. and disconnect from all that. And I think those teachers are very wise, because whether you're a teacher or a parent, you perhaps have a responsibility to remind children that it's not all go. Life, no. You know, you can't live life in the fast lane. You have to occasionally slow vehicles, move left, you know, take a little time out, just a bit of goof-off time, just a bit of twiddling your thumbs time. You know, it is very important for us to process what's gone before.
What happens in the mind, in the human condition, when we pause to do that, do you think?
That's when we interpret. That's when we make sense of what's been happening to us. And if we don't have those breaks, then of course, we get hooked, almost addicted,
yes.
to the stimulation. So if we've got out of the habit of pausing and reflecting and interpreting and making sense of what's been going on, then we just look always for the next thing and the next thing. I remember attending a church service where the preacher had the practice of having a protracted pause after his sermon.
Yes.
And now, the first time I experienced that, I thought, yeah, this is going on and on. Is someone else supposed to be standing? Has someone forgotten their lines?
There's been a mistake in the running sheet.
No, yes. But then he explained to me personally later, what's the point of giving a 10 or 15 or 20-minute carefully prepared sermon, yes. packed with significance and material that needs to be thought about, and then rushing on to the next thing? No, we want the congregation to have time just to pause and think about what they've heard before they rush on to the next thing.
How long was the excruciating length of that pause?
It probably wasn't more than 30 seconds, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It felt like about 10 minutes.
Yes.
But it was long enough for you to realise that we were just all being still and silent and letting this percolate.
And you make the point you can't even do that at the bus stop.
Yes. Yes. Oh, take a look. Next time you're waiting for a bus, take a look at your fellow commuters. And almost all of them will have a mobile phone out, and they'll be jabbing a text or tweeting or
yes.
checking their messages or doing something as though just to do what we used to do when we were waiting for a bus, which is kind of gaze unfocused into the middle distance and think about what life's like today or what yes. we've forgotten or what we need to remember to say to someone when we get home, or even just to contemplate the fact that things are a bit chaotic at the moment or that everything's wonderful, all this sort of stuff that we sometimes call smelling the roses, even if there aren't any roses there.
Yeah.
But no, we seem now to be caught with the idea that that's a waste of time and that you've got to fill the time with the message.
They're probably just tweeting, I'm waiting for the bus.
Oh, yeah. And if they're, that's right, if they're texting or if they're talking, the first question they will ask, which is now the most commonly asked question on a mobile phone, when we rang someone up, we used to say, how are you?
Yes.
Now we say, where are you?
That's true. It's true. Yeah, it's embarrassingly true, actually.
Yes.
So I want to continue the personal impact of this as well, but I also want to get into the political realm for all this rush and crush and I'd argue the dumbing down of so much of what's regarded as public communication now, it's seriously infected the political realm, hasn't it? I often feel sorry for the politicians,
yes,
to be honest.
Well, so do I. A politician makes at a doorstop interview or even in a set piece, a press conference, a politician wants to make some point, but they know that perhaps five words will be snipped out of what they've said, if they're lucky. You know, yes. It might be two words on radio, as bad as on television. You hear a news bulletin with a politician quoted and they say, no way, click.
That's it. You know, you're off.
The next thing. So politicians, of course, are beginning to adapt their own style, their own strategies, to the knowledge that this is how the media now operates, that it's all revved up, it's all getting briefer. And, of course, it's part of a larger picture, Lee, which is the commercialization of politics, by which I mean politics moving in the direction of commercial marketing, where politicians and certainly parties are treated like brands and where political announcements are treated like television commercials. So just repeat, we saw it in the 2010 federal election, the worst, in terms of the quality of the propaganda, the worst election I think any of us have ever witnessed.
I'd argue that we saw it last weekend in the ALP National Conference. Julia Gillard's speech on the Friday was widely panned as falling flat. She comes up with phrases, and apparently the speech was workshopped to within an inch of its life, phrases like, we are us.
Yes.
I mean, what's
whatever
that,
means. No, and of course, you just made a very interesting point, which is not the main purpose of our conversation, but the speech that was workshopped to death. I mean, we keep hearing about the focus groups and how everything that you see on television has gone through the focus groups. And of course, this can be a terrible trap for politicians. Where is the time for developing what Paul Keating used to refer to as the overarching narrative, you know, the vision, painting the big picture for us? If it's all going to be subject to focus groups reacting to this word or this phrase, it's political discourse being treated in the same way as advertising.
And yet I do feel sorry for them. And I can't talk because I'm caught up in the 24-hour news cyclone, as they talk about it these days. They're never left alone by the media, for instance, to go away and think.
Well, that's the other aspect of this subject we're discussing, really, which is the insatiability of apparently of the audience, but certainly of the media themselves. The media monster has to be fed. And politicians know that that's the way it's gone. No, until this modern era, by which I mean probably the last 10 years, no politician was in our faces the way contemporary politicians are. You didn't see the Prime Minister or some other key politicians on television every single night of every week the way we do now.
Yes.
It's as though you can't have a news bulletin without a talking politician. That's very. I agree with you. I feel sorry for politicians who are now caught up in the business of knowing they have to feed this monster. They have to have today's memorable phrase, you know, this thing about being on message that we hear about.
Yes.
They work out what they're going to say today and they just keep saying it all
endless
day.
Repetition. On Open House, we're with social researcher and commentator Hugh McKay on messaging each other to death. Hugh, I want to explore again how this is impacting personally upon us. The renowned thinker and philosopher Noam Chomsky has been observing the impact of the loss of what he calls just thinking time.
That's right. Chomsky was here, of course, to receive the Sydney Peace Prize just a few weeks ago. Now, a lot of people are unhappy about Chomsky's politics. A lot of people are unhappy about his linguistic theories, etc. But on the subject of the impact of technology on his own work, he's very, very interesting. And what he was saying was he gets people who email him or text message him wanting a summary of something that he's written or said.
Yes.
And so he says to people, get hold of my book or get hold of the article I wrote about this, and that and the whole point is fully developed. And he said people are just shocked at the thought that he wouldn't just give them an answer that could be encompassed in a single tweet.
140 characters.
Right, or in a YouTube clip or something. Read a book, read an entire article, you know, 5,000 words? No, we haven't got time for that. But the point he makes, of course, is you can't say anything worthwhile in 140 characters or less. You can't get across a complex idea that people will be able to comprehend and think about in a YouTube clip. It does take lots of words to do it.
He says, if it's not on YouTube, it doesn't exist.
Yes, yes. That's a frightening commentary, perhaps a slight exaggeration, but he's talking about a rising generation of young media consumers who think if something important has been said, it'll be on YouTube.
Yeah.
And if it's not there, well, it's not worth worrying about. I think that's what he was saying.
Is it a problem of literacy or is it a problem of time or a combination of both?
Well, it is a combination, Lee, but I think the critical factor in that equation is time.
Yes.
I think we've now got to the point where we think that the minutes all have to be filled with stimulation and the downtime would be boring. It's interesting how the word boring has become the ultimate put-down of kids and adolescents today. And boring.
Whatever.
Yeah. Yes. Boring's actually quite good. You know, if there's a bit of time when nothing much is happening, you could call that boring or you could call that a rich, wonderful opportunity to reflect on what's been happening for the last few hours or what you might do over the next few hours. These little way stations, little pauses in our day that many of us think of as crucial to our mental health are being swept aside in this onrush. So I think it's more about time. I mean, literacy is an interesting aspect of this too because, of course, we are inventing a new written language, the language of the text and the tweet, which is incomprehensible to many people who are still locked in the old form of written English.
Yes. I'm sure you're not saying, though, that the kinds of communication and connection that we can now access are all bad, because surely there is a lot that's good about the age in which we live.
Oh, yes. Yeah, this technology is brilliantly efficient, brilliantly convenient, brilliantly accessible and brilliantly cheap. And, of course, it's a wonderful way of making connections and maintaining connections with people you know. It's a way of augmenting relationships. It's not a replacement. And I think this is the danger, though, for a lot of kids who do get hooked on the technology, that they might be sacrificing face-to-face time in favor of screen time. But even Facebook, which is much maligned. I mean, Facebook is a sharing medium. A lot of kids are maintaining contact with each other to augment their face-to-face time. I think of Facebook as being a bit like an electronic campfire where the tribe gathers round and they're just, you know, they're just shooting the breeze. You know, they're just exchanging bits of news and gossip and random thoughts. A lot of it's pointless, A lot of it is pointless, the same as when we are gathered around a campfire.
No harm in that.
The problem is, in a real campfire, the flames die down, it starts to glow, and you gaze into those dying embers, and you get all sort of pensive and reflective, and
The
mind wanders a bit. But with Facebook, the flames never go out because we're constantly throwing more fuel on the flame. And that's why, incidentally, that famous British neuroscientist, brain researcher, Professor Susan Greenfield is now saying computers should be programmed. So I think it's every 30 minutes, she's saying. Every 30 minutes, the screen goes blank for a couple of minutes and you just have to disconnect and reconnect with the real world. It's why, for example, some recent British research has shown that people who spend most of their time at work at a screen are those who feel least connected with the organisations they work for.
How interesting. Mm. Can I ask you about email? That's such a given in our forms of communication over the last decade or two. Surely that has enhanced the efficiency of communication?
Mm. Mm. It has. Brilliantly so, Lee. I mean, we used to think of email as an interruption to our work. Now, of course, it is the way we work.
Yes.
But it has become a source of stress for many people. You go away for a few days and you come back and there are 500 emails in your inbox, and that's pretty daunting.
Yes.
So we do have to find ways of managing this and not being controlled by it. I was talking to someone recently who'd been to a course in the public service, which was designed to help people manage email stress. And one of the recommendations by the course leader was only check your email every 20 minutes. Well, I thought that would be a source of email stress for me.
Yes.
If I was checking it every 20 minutes. I do check once or twice a day. But no, look, it's a fantastic medium.
Yeah.
But of course, like all of these new screen-based media, it looks like communication. It looks like something that's bringing us together, but all these media are actually keeping us apart. When we're emailing, especially if we're emailing the person in the next office, when we're emailing, we're not in face-to-face contact. That's true of the telephone. That's
yes.
true of the handwritten letter. It's been true ever since we found ways of sending messages to each other apart from face-to-face. But one of the things we know about face-to-face communication, which is our richest form of communication, is that most of the meaning that we attach to a face-to-face conversation is actually not about the words that are being said at all.
Yes.
I mean, various researchers have various estimations of this. A famous American researcher called Morabian has studied this in great depth and says it's only about 10%
yes,
of the total meaning of a conversation that you can track to the words that are spoken. 90% comes out of the rate of speech, the tone of voice, the facial expressions, the posture, the gestures, how we're dressed, whether it's formal or casual, what kind of setting we're in, is it bright noonday sun or candlelit supper? You know, all of these things are messages. And when you strip all of those messages out and you just end up with words, especially words on a screen, you see how much richness has been lost.
Yes. You say we are to blame in all of this.
Well, we are. I mean, the technology, by the way, we always do this. We always go overboard about the new technology.
Yes. Especially in Australia.
When television arrived on the scene, we all stopped going to the movies. Then we rediscovered the joy of going to the movies. Everyone said television would kill radio. Radio, of course, has been through an extraordinary renaissance, has reinvented itself as a new kind of medium, which is many people's favourite medium, in spite of the fact they might also watch television. So we always go overboard in the beginning. And I think in the case of all of this new technology, the pendulum will swing back a bit. We'll adapt to the idea that it's good, it's useful, but it's absolutely no substitute for what humans do when they're really trying to connect with each other, which is they get in the same space and they look at each other and they smell each other and they talk.
Fancy. Do you imagine you're thinking about this is a bit like a voice crying out in the wilderness with such an overwhelming rush of technology and communication change?
I think at the moment that's true, Lee. I think very few people are speaking out against it. But as I mentioned in the case of Susan Greenfield, some of the brain scientists are now starting to talk about this from the point of view of the overload problem, the impact on our cognitive pathways of being clogged with too much data and not enough reflection time. So I think the tide is perhaps starting to turn. I've heard recently two very interesting signs of a turning tide. One was a member of my own extended family who told me recently she'd committed Facebook suicide. And what she meant was, she said, I realise I've become a lazy friend. That we're just doing it all on Facebook. We're not ringing each other up or meeting for coffee. And, you know, so we've got to disconnect from this. And I think many, many young people are coming to that conclusion. It's not yet a mass movement, but it's a trickle.
Yes.
And I heard someone just back from Europe last weekend who said in Milan, among young people now, uber cool is to have no technology.
Oh, really?
If they want me, they'll find me.
I love that. That's so anti-today. So any other practical kind of measures that we can take or think about
We've all got to become much more mindful about the available hours in the day and the amount of time we're spending with a screen. Now, I don't think anyone that you spoke to would say, my mobile phone is more important to me than my girlfriend.
No.
Or my mobile phone is more important to me than my family. So then you've got to ask the question, well, how much time do you spend on that screen or some other screen, and how much time do you spend with your family or your girlfriend in face-to-face communication, nurturing the relationship? Well, I think we'd shock ourselves if we started calculating where our time goes. And, of course, where our time goes is telling us where our heart really is.
Yes.
You can't say, my family is the most important thing in the world, and then ignore them. Makes no sense.
Yeah. Is a lot of it about loving ourselves to death as well, because we've got to be the centre of attention?
Yes. That's an interesting point, Lee. A lot of people are saying of Facebook and of, you know, even of SMS text messaging and tweeting and so on, that this is really a form of exhibitionism. This is really people wanting to be always out there.
Yes.
That may be so, although it's still a form of connection. It's still a form of sharing. But certainly the internet has fueled exhibitionism, people who want to set up a video camera and, you know, show you pictures of themselves cleaning their teeth. You know, this is carrying showing off to new depths.
Yeah. Hugh McKay, I've loved your work over so many years. I'm arrested by all these questions and considerations, and so glad that you've shared them with us on our final program on Open House for this year.
Been a great pleasure. Thank you, Lee.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.